Hi, Lloyd. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Nice to see you.
Nice to be seen.
6:05 here on a Thursday. Good morning to you. It's good to have you. And I remember going back earlier this year. That must have been, what, maybe February?
Okay.
When Terry and Arnold was accused of this kidnapping plot down in Florida.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, now he was arrested yesterday in Florida. He's facing 4 counts of kidnapping and 4 counts of armed robbery tied to this incident in the Tampa area from earlier this year. And these charges could potentially carry life sentences if he is convicted. Authorities say Arnold was involved in a plan targeting 3 men he suspected of stealing valuables from an Airbnb he was renting. Those men were allegedly lured into an apartment, held at gunpoint, assaulted, and robbed by a group of co-conspirators. Investigators say Arnold was the coordinator of this incident.
Yeah.
He was the head key figure in this case. And here's what Terry and Arnold and his people at the Airbnb in Largo said was stolen. $100,000 cash, an $80,000 necklace, other high-end jewelry, designer goods, personal items, that some of these people that may have been involved, they thought, were a driver.
Oh, okay.
Just putzing them around.
Putzing around, yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And they say they lured 3 men into an apartment under false pretenses, identified them as suspects. Victims were held at gunpoint, beaten, pistol whipped, and restrained, not allowed to leave. That's where the kidnapping charges come in.
Yeah.
And their personal belongings were stolen as well.
Wow. And the other, from what I understand, the other co-conspirators or ones who were with him, most of them have sung, mm-hmm. and some have been sentenced. I think one is waiting to be sentenced, and they're all singing and saying, yeah. Yep, he's the guy who, you know, he was the head guy. So, I mean, you know.
8 felony counts.
See, that's life if you get convicted on all that stuff, man.
And it's a shame because, you know, he seemed like a good kid.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I remember, because if I'm not mistaken, Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, you're a Cowboy fan, you don't remember. Wasn't he their pick in Detroit?
I told you never to talk to me like that, Chris. Come on. Suffered enough?
Yeah, fair. Yes, you have. Yes, you have.
That's a true statement.
I think he was their pick here in Detroit at the draft. I think Terry and Arnold was the Detroit draft pick.
I believe so, yeah. Well,
I'd have to look. Let me double check on that.
Okay.
But regardless, I just remember him saying when he was drafted, I can't wait to win a Super Bowl for this team.
Oh, yeah.
You know, things like that.
Yeah,
and
right.
now look at this. You know, it's
his life could be over. I mean,
oh, yeah. If you're out there holding people up at gunpoint and pistol whipping them. And
I mean, come on, man. Really? Yeah,
that's
did I not say the Lions just can't have nice things, right?
I walked in this morning and Jason goes, did you hear about the Terry and Arnold story? I'm like, yeah. He goes, the Lions just can't have nice things.
Well, the Lions issued a statement saying they are aware of the situation, but will not comment further out of respect for the ongoing legal
process. 2024, he was drafted in that draft.
Yeah,
was
yeah. So, it's a sad situation.
Yeah. The president has lost an appeal. Mm. He tried to get one. Michigan can continue to keep sensitive voter information private after a federal appeals court ruled against the Trump administration's effort to obtain personal data from registered voters. The 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court ruling, saying federal law does not require Michigan to release information such as birth dates, driver's license numbers, or partial Social Security numbers. Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson says the federal government can still obtain voter registration lists that are available to the public. The Trump administration argued the information is needed to verify compliance with federal election laws and investigate possible voting irregularities. State attorneys countered that the information could be used to create a national voter database and share it with federal immigration authorities. Similar lawsuits have been rejected in several other states.
Yeah, I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, I could probably make an argument on both sides of this. If you got nothing to hide, what's the problem?
What's the big deal?
But at the same time, you don't want to capitulate to the federal government because states run elections.
Yeah.
So well, I get it.
Yeah.
I get the position of the Secretary of State. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is calling for the Justice Department to investigate major oil companies. He's accusing them of keeping gasoline prices artificially high despite the sharp drop in crude oil, which fell below $70 a barrel yesterday.
Yes.
He argues that this should be translating into lower prices at the pump. In a social media post on True Social, the president said consumers are being gouged and demanded immediate action. Gas prices needed to come down, and they have come down.
They have.
I'm still seeing... I've seen them fall below $4 a gallon in my area.
Yeah.
Almost to like $3.70, excuse me.
Uh-huh.
This morning I saw them at $4.19. So there's these wild jumps.
Wow.
Where I'm at. And they are still elevated from where they were at this time last year.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think it's quite like flipping a switch. Now, this gas station over by the airport.
The $5 gas station?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something funny there.
Yeah.
It was over $5, wasn't it?
Yes. Oh,
it was
absolutely.
Like 520
or 524 or something like that. Yeah.
That's crazy. That is not.
No.
Nobody around the area is doing that.
No.
So something's wrong there.
Yeah, it's an issue. I mean, and usually the gas stations want the cheapest gas to get you to come and buy gas and hopefully go into that store because that's where they make the money.
Correct. Correct. So he wants an investigation into these gas stations.
The Detroit Pistons highly active on day two of the NBA draft, pulling off multiple trades to reshape their front court in a late night move. Detroit traded cash to the New York Knicks to acquire the 53rd overall pick, using it to select 7-foot center Uganah Onyenso from Virginia. The 21-year-old rim protector averaged nearly 3 blocks a game last season for the Cavaliers. Earlier in the evening, the Pistons dealt big man Isaiah Stewart to the Memphis Grizzlies in exchange for 3 second-round draft picks. These moves cap off a busy cycle for the Pistons, which also traded up on Tuesday night to select Samford's Ubuka Okori with the 17th overall pick. So they've been busy, man.
I saw a report yesterday that I found to be, it made my stomach turn.
Okay.
And it's not something I believe this team needs.
Okay.
I saw a report from I don't remember who the reporter was. I think it was an ESPN reporter.
Okay.
That the Pistons are going big game hunting. They want a big name. They want a star.
I heard something about they were trying to get a Laker.
Oh, guy? Yes. Yes. They were trying to get Austin Reeves. He's signing a massive max deal, 4-year max
deal.
Like
$185 million or something
like
that.
And he was undrafted. This is the highest salary ever for an undrafted player,
right,
which is a great story.
It is.
But I saw a tie-in. I saw Kawhi Leonard, which no thank you.
What?
And, ready for this? Buckle up. LeBron James.
Get out of here, man. Stop it. Stop it.
Now, unless we're getting Benson Medical Supply to...
to put the sponsor
on the jersey so this guy can have a walker out there. I don't need the corpse.
What are they trying to do to us?
LeBron, right, I'm trying to win a championship. I don't need the LeBron James's dead weight running around the court.
I heard reports are going after Miami's Tyler Hero.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Well, that, but he just got dealt to Milwaukee in that trade.
Yeah.
In the Giannis trade.
Oh, he did? Okay.
Yeah. But I had heard about that.
Yeah.
Too, yeah.
So I'm okay on...
Not LeBron.
I don't need LeBron or Kawhi Leonard.
No.
Kawhi Leonard can't stay healthy. But
All those old man walkers you could sell with the Pistons
logo. Could you imagine the giveaways down there?
Oh, dude. The giveaways will be crazy. LeBron knee ointment.
Shout out to Benson's. No offense to Benson's.
No.
Would they be thinking of having someone like LeBron just to sell tickets? Because if we bring him here, then they can put butts in seats very easily.
But they're doing that now just because how good they are.
No, okay. I mean, it would be a different level.
It will be.
If they sign LeBron James, it would be.
Well, you got people. You have people coming from everywhere. It wouldn't just be here.
He's on the very tail end of his career.
Yeah.
I mean, this next stop could be his last stop.
True.
So, plus, think, like, instead of walking down into the lower bowl, they could use those chairs like you get on your stairs and they could just ride down.
Man, LeBron's so old. Hasn't his son been in the league for 10 years already?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God. You guys are horrible this morning. Okay.
Also, I went to the Tiger game last night.
Uh-huh.
Do we have an issue with Tarek Skubal here?
He let three.
His first at bat was 3 balls, a strike, and then a home run given up. He gave up three solo home runs.
Yeah.
What is that? Six in three starts.
Two previous.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Something's a little funky there. But I don't know.
He's got the Yankees next in New York, so it doesn't get any easier.
Yankees next in New York in a short ballpark. They lose last night 4-2, lose a series.
Your son could probably knock a home run out of that park, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, with his pencil bat. Coming up on the other side, Senate candidate Mike Rogers joins us. He's tying the Gordie Howe bridge opening to these. We'll tell you what it is next. So, JR Morning. So, U.S. Senate candidate Mike Rogers backing this idea of using the opening of the Gordie Howe bridge as leverage for this broader trade negotiation with Canada, specifically over tariffs on Chinese-made vehicles. And in this period where the United States and Canada aren't quite seeing eye to eye on a number of things, the Canadian government went out, reached out to China. They're talking about bringing in, you know, tens of thousands of these Chinese EVs. And one of the impetuses for some legislation that even Alyssa Slotkin was putting out there was barring these vehicles from coming into the United States for day trips across our borders.
Exactly.
And so this is something that Mike Rogers is thinking about as well, and the U.S. Senate candidate joins us this morning to talk about it. Mike, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning, Chris Lloyd. Great to have you.
So let's talk a little bit about the Gordie Howe International Bridge at this point. You know, there's been, I think, some frustration that it hasn't opened yet. What's your perspective on why, and what do you think needs to happen in order for this thing to open up?
Well, listen, our Canadian friends have not been good partners on what the automobile business is going to look like. So they've dropped those tariffs from 100% to 6% on 100% Chinese-made cars. They've upped the quota, will be eventually over 70,000 of those cars. And what that does is really important. About 25 to 30% of even the cars that are made in Canada have U.S. content. So, or let me rephrase that, 25 to 30% of the cars that are made in Canada have U.S. content. So all of our parts suppliers, all those small shops that are doing parts for those cars are at risk. And the greatest existential threat to the United States auto worker jobs in our auto companies are Chinese-made automobiles. And the pressure is on to get them back across the border, number one. But they're also putting pressure on Washington, D.C., the Chinese, trying to make sure that they can produce cars here in America. And why this is important, they don't care about making money. They want to own the market, period, pure and simple. I mean, we have a small little startup company here called Slate that's trying to build electric vehicles. I think it's out of Troy. Really unique concept of modular builds for these cars, really kind of clever. All of that goes at risk, and we should use every bit of leverage for some tough negotiating with our Canadian friends as we can. They might not care if they have an auto industry in 10 years. I do.
If Canada refuses to change its policies, would you still support opening the bridge, or should it remain closed until an agreement is reached?
Well, I mean, you never say never. I would go have a pretty tough negotiation between now and then, and here's the good news, people forget. The people that own the other bridge are paying taxes. So once that bridge probably is either diminished or whatever, that tax base goes away. Canadians are not paying the United States any taxes, I'll guarantee you that. So I'm not too worried about the length of this thing. I am worried about the consequence. If it weren't for so dire of what could happen to automobile jobs here in the state of Michigan, then, you know, you can play, you know, gee whiz. But this is, again, probably the biggest threat we have. To our ability to produce cars and keep these auto jobs here in Michigan.
So the USMCA, there's a broader issue here too. It is going to expire in 2036. So 10 years from now, it will expire. But there is supposed to be a joint review on July 1st in just a few days that mandates all three companies get together to talk about this agreement, and they're going to review this. Do you think they're going to be able to make headway in those conversations on the bridge?
I don't know if that's going to be the sole focus of it. I mean, obviously, that bridge is of little of Mexico's concern.
Sure.
But when you look, I think we have to step back for a minute. If we have this bridge open 2 months, 3 months, 6 months later, and we win a significant concession from Canada about these Chinese cars, that's significant for auto workers right here in the state and keeping their jobs. That's worth having a little scuffle over. You know, we can't just continue to give this stuff away. You know, just in the last decade, we've lost 40,000 manufacturing jobs here in Michigan. Those are middle-class jobs. They're gone. And by the way, happened to be under the Democrats in Lansing, and for 32 years, two Democrats in the United States Senate. I mean, that's why this is such an important change election. We have got to fight for every single job here, because the Chinese would love nothing more than to have only customers here in the United States that don't build anything. And it's, we've seen the consequences of this. We've seen the consequences of the Democrats raising our utility rates or raising the cost of doing business here. We've seen the consequences of it. We're living it right now. And why we wouldn't use this as an opportunity to get this done. It is no money out of our pocket having that bridge closed for another 6 months. Matter of fact, I argue that the other bridge pays taxes, as we discussed. So let's use this as an opportunity to get this right. If not, how many more jobs are you willing to ship out of the state of Michigan? I don't know about you guys. I'm not willing to do that anymore. We need to get Michigan back up on off of our knees and growing again and being the envy of the country when it comes to high-end manufacturing.
We have 30 seconds left here. Obviously, you're fighting for this open U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Gary Peters. Are you looking at the trends? How are things looking on your end?
We're looking great. I mean, people know this is a change election. We just talked about it. 32 years of the same party representing Michigan. You know, we've lost air bases. We've lost the main battle tank production. We've lost tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs. Our energy rates are too high. People are looking to move. Your kids are looking to move south. We've got to change all that, and people know it, and we have solutions. If you go to rogersforsenate.com, we have solutions for all of this, including getting our kids educated again. So we're feeling great. Our polls are showing that we're beating all three of the Democrats that are getting more radical, more crazy. And you know what? This is going to be common sense versus crazy.
Mike Rogers,
we'll common sense.
We appreciate your time as always. Thank you. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. Coming up on the other side, tech stocks are slumping. What does that mean? Chris Alberta joins us to break it down. It's Jared Morning. So interesting, earlier this week, shares of artificial intelligence chip makers had plunged all around the world. It certainly pulled down major stock indexes. There was a renewed batch of scrutiny on the AI industry, like semiconductors. Micron, SanDisk saw shares tumble more than 10% in afternoon trading. NVIDIA saw a 3% value drop earlier in the week as well. The NASDAQ declined 1.4%. On Tuesday, the S&P 500 fell nearly 1%. The South Korean benchmark fell 10% as well. So these numbers are shocking.
Yeah.
For a market that many assume is being held up by the tech industry. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean? Chris Alberta, the CEO of Principium Tactical Wealth Management, joins us this morning to talk about it. Chris, good morning. It's good to have you back, my friend.
Good morning, boys. It's funny, isn't it, how the impetus for this conversation really was based on a couple pieces that are now fake news.
Yeah, well, that's why we wanted to talk with you about
right.
it. So what exactly is going on here?
Well, look, the rudimentary part, which is pretty interesting, is you got to remember the basics. Everything that inhales has to exhale, and big, big inhales lead to big exhales. Mm. So the major mover here that was talked about the most is Micron. They make chips that are the AI environment is rather dependent on. Micron is up 270% year to date. So if you had $10,000 in Micron on January 1st, you're roughly around 27 grand today. Hmm. This is not uncommon. Something that's up 270%, pulling back 13% in a weird, wacky day, which also aligns with earnings. Let's talk about that in a second, is not uncommon. So these prognosticators that go out and write these articles, I saw the one from Axios, for example, that you guys sent over, mm-hmm. they're all looking to be right. I mean, that's what they hang their hat on. They're not too dissimilar, frankly, to like a movie critic sitting in an apartment in New York City with their, you know, with their incense burning. So if you look at that scenario and say, why does that happen? It happens because people get pessimistic about earnings reports. Earnings reports come out, in many cases, quarterly. And the idea is that company needs now to show the books, so to speak. Are we selling enough chips in this case to justify the excitement? Because if you're not selling chips, you're not making money. And if you're not making money, you can't turn around and please your investors. So if there is any kind of cynicism or pessimism, around the earnings being poorer than expected, some people will sell off some or most or all of their positions because they've already done so good for the year. They're like, hey, in case this earnings report is crappy, I want to seal up my gains. This is not uncommon. So, of course, it drops 13%. Then the very next day, the earnings report comes out surpassing expectations, and it jumps right back up to where it was. Oh, there was, it's just like you look at AccuWeather and there's supposed to be a horrendous thunderstorm, and then you watch outside, nothing happens.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not a call that the AI run is over. There was just a little bit of a bump in the road. But if I'm up 270%, it falls 13%, and I'm still up 250% and change, I'm pretty okay with that.
So for investors who've done very well in AI stocks over the past year, is it now time to take some profits and rebalance?
Well, that's up to them. Because again, it depends, Lloyd, on investor behavior, their age, their risk tolerance. Are they still working? Can they afford to have a really big series of jagged edges? But I think that the last year or so at a minimum has proved that the AI thing is going nowhere. It's going to continue to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that you're not going to have large exhales along the way. We talked now, two or three times, the three of us, just about SpaceX, right? SpaceX is an epicenter of a lot of this kind of stuff, and they just raised the better part of $100 billion for new projects in the AI space. Clearly, it's not going away.
Well, and I think, to your point, depends on where you're at. Where you're at.
Yeah,
in your life. If you feel like if you're up 250 and you want to cash out for millions of dollars because you don't want to play the game anymore, God bless. It's probably a great time for it.
Yeah.
I think the analogy of the large exhale and the large inhale, large exhale makes a lot of sense because you can't have a large inhale and a small exhale.
Mm-mm.
You don't have the lung.
You can't just hold on to it.
Right. You don't have the lung capacity for it. So it's very similar here. The bumps in the road, though, I mean, they are significant. So if you don't hold a mass amount of stock in the tech industry, then you might feel it a little more. But again, the rebound's been pretty quick.
Yeah, and that's, modern investors too, we have the blessing, if you will, of having, exchange traded funds, ETFs that are a perfect mirror image of specific index. So for example, all of these tech companies, not all of them, the majority of them, they're traded on NASDAQ, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a great many people at this point who just own the NASDAQ. They don't own Micron individually. They don't own, for example, NVIDIA individually. They may, but if they're doing that, they're typically doing it with a fraction of the portfolio. But, it's a high tide raises all boats type of thing. If you own the NASDAQ, you've experienced some of the gain of something like Micron up 270% and many others. But you're not then, you're diluting the total return that you could have had. But you're also spreading that risk across thousands of stock positions, which is the whole point of internal diversification. So there's more than one way to skin a cat. I mean, the fact that somebody might have a position in Micron individually and had a day where they looked and went, oh, man, I was up like crazy, and now I'm back a little bit. On the overall, they're still way, way up. And that's the big picture that everyone has to grasp. Same thing with the S&P 500.
Chris, when you look past the daily headlines and the stock market swings, what should investors really be kind of paying attention to when it comes to AI and their financial future?
I mean, I think that this is one of those times where the cliche absolutely fits. I mean, if you have all your eggs in that particular basket, I mean, you're going to have some crackage at some point and you're going to get yolk on your fingers. There's just no two ways about it. But again, that's why, the broad diversification for most people's portfolios mean that AI is such a powerful force. In fact, it's probably the most powerful force we've seen in a long, long, long time. It's propping up the major markets almost independently.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare is doing okay, but tech is killing it. So if you're an individual investor and you're saying to yourself, look, I'm, still 10, 15 years worth of work left, and I'm in my 401k, and every time I get paid, I'm putting new money into the market. It's good to be able to dollar cost average that money in across all of those sectors. And if they're leaning a little bit more heavily into the tech, which right now makes the most sense, they've probably done very, very well. But long term, most everybody needs to remember that, if they act wealthy, they tend to end up wealthy. I mean, we kind of become what we think about most when it comes to investing. And that requires having the majority of your portfolio being in foot soldier territory, just marching steadily ahead. And if you have some home run type stuff in your portfolio and occasionally it hits a grand slam, great. But if you sit there and swing the bat at every single pitch, eventually you have strikeouts too.
Yep.
So really, it just comes down to basic old school diversification and being kind of sound of mind when it comes to not risking something you can't live without.
Were you watching the Tigers last night? Is that where that baseball analogy came from?
No, but I went to the Tigers game the other day, and I watched 7 innings with no hits, and I was baking in the sun, and I thought, why the hell am I here?
So that's where it came from.
Okay.
And that's why you need experts like Chris Alberta to break it down. We appreciate it, as always. Thank you.
Gotcha, fellas.
Yeah,
talk to you.
You got it. We'll talk soon. Coming up on the other side, the battle for affordability, and Republicans are trending in a tough direction right now based on national trends that we're seeing.
Yeah.
Can they ease the cost of living, truly, prior to the midterms?
Somebody has a plan.
We'll talk about it. It's coming up on JR Morning. All right, here's your chance to win a trip to see 2 country superstars in Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan in Vegas. Double the hits, 1 unforgettable night. We've got your flights, hotel, and concert tickets covered. The Double Down Tour, Aldean and Bryan co-headlining with special guests John Pardee and Chase Matthews. All live under the neon lights. Prize provided by BBR Music Group. Texas Hour's national keyword, town, to 95819. That's TOWN. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Official rules and more info is at WJR.com. I don't listen to them very often.
Okay.
But they are wildly popular and talented. They are really, really good. It's going to be a fun show.
It's going to be a good show.
Meanwhile, this idea of affordability has been a major issue for the American public. It was certainly a flashpoint in the 2024 election. Unfortunately, we haven't seen costs come down the way that I think many people would like.
Yeah.
And that's across almost everything
mm-hmm.
in life.
Mm-hmm.
It's across affordable housing. It's across gas prices,
groceries.
And grocery prices, mm-hmm. all of those things. Everything seems to be just more expensive, and it's having an impact on a lot of folks. So what can be done from a Republican perspective before the midterms to try to turn the dial more towards their favor? Ken Davis is a former finance executive for Fortune 500 companies. He's the former deputy attorney general for this great state of Virginia and joins us this morning. Ken, it's great to have you.
Good morning. It's great to be on your wonderful program.
Thank you. Well, let's talk a little bit about what Republicans can do, because, you know, based on what we've seen, despite the internal struggles of the Democratic Party, the trends seem to be pointing their way once we hit November. So if affordability is the major issue or one of the top 3 issues, call it, how do Republicans right the ship on that front?
Well, as you point out, prices of a lot of things, gas is coming down, but it's still higher than people would like it to be. Groceries, things are high. Now, one of the major expenses, economic burdens for people is tax at the federal level and state level. And at the federal level, it's a tremendous burden. And there's a problem with the federal tax code, an unfairness, unnecessary economic burden that's been in place for years that the Republicans could address with a reconciliation package. There is some talk about a third reconciliation package. And for that to pass, they just need a majority, and they have a slim majority in both houses, that they are in great danger of losing unless they address affordability. And they could do this by focusing on the income tax and specifically paycheck withholding.
Mm.
That's a basic feature of the income taxes that we all pay. It's been in place since the Second World War, and it takes a lot of money out of paychecks over the course of a year. Most income taxes, in fact, are withheld in paychecks from paychecks and sent to the government through the course of the year, months ahead of April 15th the following year.
Interesting.
And it's about $2.6 trillion is taken out of your pay. Well, not your paycheck.
I was going to say that. Don't give away the goods, Ken.
Yours and mine and all the paychecks in America. And we get no compensation, no interest for the essentially the loans that we are advancing, the advance payments that we are making to the government.
And, you know, if a bank held your money for months without paying interest, most people would have a fit. But, you know, why has this, you know, practice largely escaped public debate?
Well, you know, it's one small step at a time, one incremental change by the government for the government's favor at a time. When the income tax was first put into effect in 1913, there was no withholding. And, oh, by the way, rates were really low. Mm-hmm. It was about 1%, a flat rate, that because of many, many exemptions that were also included in the first package, only about 2% of American households were covered by the income tax. So it started small, and the people who were covered made their payment on April the 15th each year when they filed their returns, their 1040s.
Well, it is an interesting perspective because you probably, I mean, there would be at some point a start date for something like this,
sure,
but you would see an immediate influx of cash into your pocket if you're not paying that particular tax.
Yeah.
So it would be a way to show the American people quickly that they're putting more money in their pockets. It really interesting perspective, outside the box thinking. Ken Davis, unfortunately, we got to run, but we appreciate your time. We hope to talk with you again very soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
Wow. Well, you know, out the box, thinking of different ways.
I mean, appreciate that.
Yeah.
7 o'clock hour coming up. We've got some data centers, the whipping boy for AI. It's all coming up on JR Morning. 7:05 here on a Thursday. Boy, it's already Thursday.
It is already Thursday.
Yay!
Yeah, that's right. Play it. It's Thursday. We
Friday
love it.
Eve.
Friday Eve. Exactly. Excuse me.
Uh-huh.
Boy, this Tarion Arnold story, crazy. He was arrested yesterday in Florida facing 4 counts of kidnapping, 4 counts of armed robbery tied to this incident in the greater Tampa area earlier this year. If he's convicted on all these charges,
yeah,
a potential life sentence.
Dude, he could be
for
done.
Lions cornerback Tarion Arnold.
He'll be in court today for a conference in front of the judge. And, you know, they want to keep him locked up until the trial. That's going to be an issue right there for him, you know, missing training camp and all of that, you know. So I don't know what they're going to have to do to try to get him out on some type of bond, but they're going to try today.
So authorities say Arnold was involved in this plan targeting 3 men. He's suspected of stealing valuables from an Airbnb he was renting, like $100,000 in cash, an $80,000 necklace, designer goods and personal items. And there have been other people that have been arrested in this incident as well. And they're saying that he's the primary guy in all of this. And he helped organize and direct the setup. He was a part of the group chat organizing the plan and was apparently watching the attack via live stream before these people showed up. So he was like posting out essentially and waiting for them. And 6 other people have been arrested for this.
And supposedly there are text messages as well, you know, with everybody kind of like group text messaging and all of that. So yeah, it's going to be an uphill battle for.
And the Lions are just saying, you know, we know about it.
Yep.
We don't have much to say about it. And of course they're not going to, or should they, quite frankly, but no, they're not going to say anything about this just yet. You know, a kid with a lot of promise, now this is a whole different ballgame for him.
It could just, his life could just be done. I mean, you know, if he gets convicted and, you know, life in prison for a young man like that, it's a shame. The Pistons were active yesterday in the NBA draft. They pulled off trades to reshape their front court in a late night move. Detroit traded cash to the New York Knicks to acquire the 53rd overall pick, using it to select 7-foot center Uganah Onyeka from Virginia. The 21-year-old center averaged nearly 3 blocks a game last season for the Cavaliers. Earlier in the evening, the Pistons, as you know, dealt big man Isaiah Stewart to the Memphis Grizzlies in exchange for second-round draft picks. And the move caps off that busy draft cycle for the Pistons, which also traded up on Tuesday night, as you know, selecting Stanford's Yabuka Okori with the 17th overall pick.
Yeah, and now there's these reports that the Pistons could potentially be going after a big name, going after a big star, a big player, somebody that could come in and help this team right away. I mean, I've seen Kawhi Leonard. I've seen LeBron James. I'm good on both of them. Oh. No, thank you.
Papa.
Grandpapa. Really quickly, though, not for nothing, LeBron James is a big Ohio State fan. I'm not even sure that he'd want to play in the state of Michigan.
No, you know, I would think
he's that loyal to the state of Ohio. I'm serious. Yeah, I don't know that he really would.
I think
that's how deep that rivalry goes.
Before he would come here, I think he would try to go to New York.
The Knicks?
Yeah. I mean, because the Lakers are Showtime. The Knicks is Showtime. You know what I mean? Big name, you know, big lights, bright city. Stars, all of that.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, if he's going to do, let's just say he's going to do one more year and
yeah,
be done.
Right.
I think, you know, the Knicks are the champions. He would try to go there and get another ring and
only free up a little more cap space with the beef stew trade. So,
it would.
Interesting enough. I was at the Tiger game last night, mm-hmm. and Tarek Skubal was on the bump. They lose 4-2, but he did not have a great night. And then at one point, it looked like he got injured. The training staff came out and looked at him. He threw a couple warm-up pitches, says he was okay. Here's A.J. Hinz on Tarek Skubal's night.
Yeah, the homers, you know, what you think he gave up 4 hits. 3 of them were homers. And I think they were different pitches, too. I mean, Goldie's had some success against him. He's hit the ball out of the ballpark. And then I think the changeup middle-middle to Dominguez, you know, was a tough blow for him. But you know, I thought he looked great. He was aggressive. You know, I thought early he sprayed it just a little bit, and then he locked things in and started punching guys out. His pitch count was low. He was starting to get that swagger in the game that we know and love. And you know, they just burned him with the hits they did get were, you know, left the ballpark, and that's very unusual. But they did their part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Certainly. Yeah. And Skubal said his stuff has been good, but, you know,
yeah,
6 home runs in 3 starts is not ideal.
My stuff has been pretty good, you know, in terms of the stuff coming out of my hand and what I'm looking at and kind of what I monitor, you know, and how I hold myself accountable. I've kind of been checking all those boxes. It's just the results haven't been there. And it's tough. You know, this game will beat you up if you let it. But like I said earlier, results are kind of what matters right now. You know, getting zeros, getting our team in the dugout. Giving our team a chance to win, that's what matters, and I just haven't been able to do that.
Mm. So they lose the series to the Yankees. Mm.
But on the bright side, yeah, he did give up only 4 hits, 3 left the yard, no walks. He rarely ever walks anybody.
No,
he is so mad when he walks people.
His ball-to-strike ratio is still very, very good.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
So we're playing them again.
Yeah, he's got him next week at Yankee Stadium.
Okay. Yeah, at Yankee Stadium.
All right. If you know where Eminem's ex-wife is, you might want to just call the Macomb County.
Will the real Kim office. Mathers please stand up?
She didn't show up for a sentencing hearing yesterday. She was supposed to be sentenced for that February hit and run. She didn't show up. So now there's a bench warrant out for her, and they're looking. So if you know where she is, just, you know, give the Macomb County Prosecutor's Office a call.
Pete Lucido. Call Pete Lucido.
Call Pete.
Okay. Very good. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, a spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Who's visiting web pages these days? Well, humans are, of course, right? Well, hold on. As reported by Morning Brew, we have news that now bots make up 58% of all worldwide traffic to web pages. That, according to data compiled by the network security provider Cloudflare. Human-generated traffic, meanwhile, accounted for only 42%. Matthew Prince, Cloudflare co-founder and CEO, wrote on X, and I'm quoting, "Well, that happened faster than predicted. Agentic traffic is growing so fast that bots have now passed human traffic online for the first time in the history of the internet." Now, okay, Is this a so what or is this a real issue? Well, it is not a so what. You see, with all of this bot traffic going to web pages, key metrics like views, impressions, site visits, you know, the kind of metrics that are the backbone of the online advertising industry are now so skewed that it's becoming harder to provide material accounting for advertising effectiveness in many cases. And that makes it harder to secure and retain clients if you're an agency, and it affects the businesses and brands who are conducting online advertising and want to know that, in fact, it's working based on real-world metrics reflecting human traffic. So what to do? Well, to be clear, there is no choice but to confront the problem head-on and implement solutions that address the issue, whether building a wall, if you will, to prevent bots from accessing your site, or simply finding ways to filter the data effectively so that your metrics actually reflect real human traffic versus that of the bots. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So all of the sports ramifications aside, what it would mean for the Lions if Terry and Arnold isn't available to play this year, on the legal side, there are some real problems here for Terry and Arnold because, you know, these counts that he is charged with, four counts of armed robbery, four counts of kidnapping. If he's convicted on these charges stemming from this incident back in February, he could be facing life in prison.
That's true.
After all of this. And really, for what? $100,000 cash, an $80,000 necklace, and some designer handbags that he says was stolen from him. Mm-hmm. And this was a retaliation, essentially, to try to get these things back. Let's break it down with Todd Flood of Flood Law. And, of course, his show here on WJR, Behind the Bench, airs every third Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Todd, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Of course. What do you make of this Terry and Arnold case? He maintains that he had nothing to do with it, that that he is innocent of all of these charges. But at the same time, there seems to be some evidence pointing to the fact that there are text messages, there are these co-conspirators who are pointing to him being the linchpin of all of this. What do you make of it?
Well, the defense kind of put out their defense. You can't believe these guys. They don't have morals. They have rules. What's in it for me? So they're all apparently to the defense prior felons that are lying for whatever they want to lie for. That's what the defense is. You can't trust the people that are talking. The prosecution, the government, and you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head here. He's facing some serious consequences, even a mandatory minimum of 10 to 20 up to life. So but the key to the government is that you have a motive and you got a timeline, and then you put the icing on top of it. You have contemporaneous communications going on, allegedly from his cell phone. Mm-hmm. So you got a guy that Arnold reports he's got about $250,000 missing, what, on February 3rd? February 4th, just hours after, is, you know, the narrative basically is the retaliation, and they get three victims, and from, you know, alleged to have been involved in this stealing of his goods. So top that with the knowledge that he's talking about something, right? Because mm-hmm. you got a group chat authenticating, you know, basically saying, hey, listen, this is what we got to do. So I think it's you don't charge cases like this, guys. You don't charge cases like this one as a prosecutor. I'd always look at it from the standpoint, not probable cause. I'd look at it from the standpoint of charging something this serious. I want to be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
I act like I'm the prosecutor that's going to try the case, not the one that's just signing the warrant. So, I want to leave my colleagues in a position where I'm not giving them a bad case. So, you know, they have, I would imagine, quite a bit of evidence to go with.
Todd, the state attorney wants Arnold kept in jail until trial. There's a pretrial detention hearing this afternoon. What does the defense have to show to get him out on bond?
Great question, Lloyd. So two things. And Florida has the same bond hearing that we have here in Michigan and the same standards. There's two things that the defense, since one of the few times defense has a burden, only two times they do in criminal law, but the burden for the defense is simply this. It has to show that he's not a threat to the community and that he's not a flight risk, right? We mm-hmm. have to be able to show that, you know, he's going to have obviously a magnifying glass on him wherever he goes if he were let out on a bond, right? It would be a celebrity person. So he's not going to be able to basically, you know, get out of the United States. He's going to have a passport issue. He's going to have, you know, cameras following him everywhere. So we have to show that he's going to be able to return. They want to keep him because they say, hey, listen, this is a mandatory minimum charge, 10 years. And it's the second prong of this. It's a serious threat to our community. And he could be a flight risk. He could go to a country that doesn't have extradition. He could go to some place with private jets and the money he may have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So he might be a flight risk. That's one. Two, this is a serious, I mean, guns involved, you know, this is a serious crime. What's the threat to the community at large? If it was regular Joe, you know, six pack on the street, there's not going to be a bond given that's very light. We have a right to bond. But at the end of the day here, you know, he's alleged to have committed a felonious assault, a robbery, guns involved, kidnapping. Those are all really serious, and the penalty for which, and get this, the kidnapping and the armed robbery, they're consecutive sentences. So he would have one sentence of found guilty, complete that, and then he'd have to do the next one. Mm. So it's a serious charge. So getting out on bond, is he a flight risk? One. Two, is he a threat to the community? That's what the judge is going to look at. Defense is going to have to show that he's not a flight risk. We've had those cases before here in the city of Detroit where we've had high-profile people. We've shown, hey, judge, look, you got a camera in the courtroom. You got five cameras outside waiting to see him. So everyone's going to be following this guy. He's not a flight risk. He's going to be like a magnifying glass. That's what I'd argue. Uh-huh. Two, you know, I'd argue, hey, listen, you know, the fact of the matter is that if he were to violate your bond, it would be a compelling reason, if ever found guilty, that you could have a substantial and compelling reason to sentence him over the guidelines of that base minimum. So, you know, he'd have to be a cherub, that being an angel, right? So he'd have to be, an idiot to violate your bond, judge. You got a big stick over his head. That's what I'd argue as a defense attorney. If I was the prosecutor, I'd be arguing, are you out of your mind? He, you know, the likelihood of this guy's conviction is high. And two, we got the, you know, the fact that he's going to be going to prison because of this. So that's what I'd be arguing for this.
He doesn't have a past criminal history. Does that play here?
Absolutely. It does. You know, he's it doesn't have any kind of back record. He's been, you know, a good name in the community. He's got family and friends. He has close ties. Things of those sorts, you know, you'd argue those things to show that he's an upstanding person, and you'd get character references and character letters and people that know him to attest, you know, in a bond motion. I would attach all those exhibits and letters to my bond motion to say, hey, listen, look at all these people. This is definitely not him. You got the wrong guy.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. Ty, we appreciate you hopping on with us this morning. Thank you. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Yep, you got it. That's Todd Flood at Flood Law, and make sure you listen every third Wednesday here on WJR, third Wednesday of the month, Behind the Bench with Todd Flood at 7 o'clock here on WJR. Great legal analysis. From
Absolutely, Todd. Because it's, you know, they want to hold him until trial, and the defense, they have an uphill battle to try to get the judge to go another way and give him a bond and let him out.
Mm-hmm.
If not, if he's in to the trial, all of the camp and all of that is out the window.
Lloyd, I don't know. I don't know how you roll around with $100,000 cash. I don't know how you roll around with an $80,000 necklace. I don't understand any of that.
No,
stuff.
I don't either. But
was it Chad Johnson? Chad Johnson said that none of his jewelry is real. It's all fake.
Uh-huh, right.
Because why are you rolling around with $100,000 on your neck?
I just don't
It's understand. Crazy to me.
Well, I mean, look.
And if you're worth, you know, $14 million.
Look at Floyd Mayweather. He has a backpack where he has, like, stacks of $100 bills. He's counting them on the floor of the freaking basketball arena.
We're talking Taylor Swift and Oprah. Next is JR Morning. All right, I do want to issue a bit of a statement before we get into these next topics.
Okay.
I can only speak for me. I cannot speak for you. If you would like to issue something similar, you may. I am not Taylor Swift's demographic.
I'm not either.
I am not her target audience, okay? I am a bit more the target audience of Travis Kelce.
Okay.
But I honestly really couldn't possibly care less about Taylor Swift, their engagement, their wedding. It doesn't matter to me.
But, you know, it's just like a lot of these other major stars who've been married, and they try to get married in secret places, and you got drones and helicopters flying over mountains and stuff. It's just crazy.
You do you.
Yeah.
This is your business.
Exactly.
It's not my business. This is your business. This is your life. I don't care.
That's right. It's not affecting me one way or another.
But I will tell you, these Swifties, could we divert their attention to Nancy Guthrie?
Absolutely right.
Anybody want to help negotiate with Iran?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you people out there are sleuths.
They are for real, for real. Yes.
It is amazing what these people go through. Mm-hmm. And Taylor Swift eggs them on. She puts out these little things, and people go, oh, I got to put my detective glasses on and get my notepad out, and here
she's,
I am.
She's a master marketer.
No, she is.
Nothing else.
She is the marketer. Yes. There is nobody better in history at marketing than Taylor Swift.
She is great.
And her team.
Yes.
But this wedding that's coming up, apparently coming up, in just a few days.
Okay.
At Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, I cannot speak for Taylor Swift. I don't know the woman. But it seems like she is, it seems to me that she is into more of like a, you know, quaint, like wants to do her own thing. Her life's pretty private for the most part. She doesn't, you know, share a lot of, I mean, I don't know, about that side of herself.
Yeah.
But this rumor was flying around that she and Travis Kelce were going to get married at Madison Square Garden.
Right.
And there's these, I think there are like podcasts dedicated to Taylor Swift. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
But these people are like, oh, this is crazy. She would never get married at a big cavernous arena. That's not her style, blah, blah, blah. Well, now this rumor seems to have materialized even further because TMZ is reporting that Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce would be wed at Madison Square Garden Friday, July 3rd. They've invited more than 1,000 guests. They've spent millions of dollars to rent out this area. Page Six published their own exclusive. Anonymous sources saying that MSG was indeed the plan, especially because the pair's priority was privacy, and they were considering using buses with blacked-out windows to transport attendees. I imagine there would be some pretty famous folks there. And the New York Times has published evidence that a permit was filed to close the streets around Madison Square Garden on July 3rd, according to a city official. So, like, this is happening. Here's my question. People were angry that Donald Trump was going to the Knicks game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A Knicks finals game.
Yes.
And all of the extra security streets closed around Madison Square Garden.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
So all I'm asking for is the same outrage for Taylor Swift getting married at Madison Square Garden, having to close streets around the arena so that her and 1,000 people can watch them get married.
Well, let me tell you, you know this, you know, whoever says some negative stuff about it, the Swifties will jump on them. And
I don't care. I don't care.
You know, I'm just saying.
You say whatever you need to. Chris.Renwick@Cumulus.com is my email. You can send all Taylor Swift hate mail there.
I'm typing right now.
Yeah, but I know you are. Am I crazy? Yeah,
no.
Am I living in bizarro world? What is this?
It's crazy. And, you know, and I think it's all part of the marketing as well. This will end up on a, you know, pay-per-view for concert or on some Netflix or something. The wedding of Taylor Swift. Come.
All right, let's clip this. Put it on social media. I want Taylor Swift to see it. I need her to respond.
I want a very 800-859-0957,
Taylor.
I'm going to have a very small, intimate wedding.
At Madison Square Garden
and close it down. Tickets are only $1,200 a piece.
Right.
There'll be t-shirts in
yeah,
the lobby.
Yeah, merchandise.
Oh, of course.
The wedding.
Yes.
That's why it's all like, this is all a con job. This is,
I'm telling you,
know, you
man.
Come
it's
on.
Marketing.
Master marketer.
Yes. That's what she's doing. Okay. So, Oprah Winfrey was in Cannes and doing an
interview. The film festival?
Yes.
Okay.
Doing an interview with a reporter on a stage. And they, for some reason, they got on the subject of Whitney Houston. And
who died 14 years ago.
Exactly.
Got it.
And so she said when Whitney last came to her show that Whitney was high. And she fell off the stage. And there were people in the audience who had cameras.
This is the Oprah Winfrey show?
The Oprah Winfrey show.
Okay.
And I remember watching the show. I mean, you can pull it up on YouTube right okay. now. Watch that show. And said she was high and that she fell off the stage. And that there, you know, the audience was there and they had cameras. And Oprah said she told her audience, please, do not take pictures. Do not do that and put this out there because this would ruin her life. This would ruin Whitney's life. So don't do it. And please don't do it. And she said nobody did it. It never came out. But she just decided to tell it, I guess, in Cannes with this interview. I don't know why she decided now, 14 years later, but okay. She
is there a Whitney Houston documentary movie coming out?
No.
Okay.
No. So now the family has responded and said, hold it, wait a minute, Oprah. Wait a minute. We know Whitney had issues, and we knew she, you know, did drugs, but she was not under the influence on your show. And she, yes, she did fall, but she fell during dress rehearsal, and it was poor lighting on the stage, and she stepped wrong and fell off the stage. It would, had nothing to do with her being high. And so you got that wrong, and we don't like it, and you need to retract that. Well, Oprah hasn't said anything yet. Now Whitney's bodyguard has come up, who's with her all the time. He was the guy.
Kevin Costner.
That guy.
Oh.
But he was the guy who found her body when she passed away. He was the first guy to find her, her bodyguard. He said, no. Whitney had issues, and she had done drugs before, and she had been on drugs, but she was clean, and she was clean there, and she stepped wrong because it was poor lighting, and she fell during dress rehearsal. And so the family is saying, listen, we know she had issues with drugs, but not everything that happened to Whitney Houston had something to do with drugs.
Why? What is the purpose of all of this now?
I don't know. I don't know why Oprah brought it up in the first place. I don't know, you know, and why she decided to tell this story 14 years later. I don't know what made her want to talk about that.
I'll be honest. I don't look at Oprah the same way as probably most people do.
No, and my son and my kids don't either.
I'm 37.
Yeah.
Like, my memory of Oprah is, you're going to call, and you're going to call.
And that was the back.
That's my memory of Oprah.
Which is the back end
right.
of Oprah. The front end
It was
of
the
Oprah.
Caricature of Oprah.
Yes.
Like, Oprah, I mean, obviously, is a mogul. She's incredible.
Sure, she's a billionaire.
She built an absolute behemoth of a brand.
Yes.
But, like, I don't really care what Oprah has to say. If Whitney Houston fell off the stage, then I guess she fell off the stage. I don't know whether she was on drugs or not.
Yeah.
Whitney Houston is the greatest female vocalist of all time.
I agree.
In my mind.
I agree.
So, like, I don't know what that has to do with the price of tea in China.
People, you know, people respect Oprah. And, yeah, the latter part of Oprah is that you got a car, you got a car, you get a car, you get a car. But the front half of Oprah is the woman who came after Phil Donahue, who was the man who basically started all of this talk show
right.
stuff. And Phil was the man.
Right.
Phil was the man. Then Oprah came along and was kind of like the female version of Phil Donahue.
Sure.
And then it kind of turned into other things. And then, you know, you get the you get a car, you get a car, you
yeah.
get all these other shows where people are fighting and stuff. It got crazy
yeah.
after that. But
yeah.
it didn't start that way. And Oprah got her respect, I think, on the front end. And, you know, it kind of went south on the back end.
It's wild that she would just bring this up.
It is. And nobody knows why. And nobody's heard from Oprah like, oh. Well,
oh, now she's just gone dark again?
She's nobody heard.
Radio silence from
yeah.
Oprah now?
And, you know, Oprah likes to talk, but she's not saying anything about this.
She just came in, dropped a bomb, and left?
Yep, that's it.
Okay. Thanks, Oprah. Appreciate that. Our data center is the new whipping boy of AI. We're talking about that next. It's JR Morning. All right, so the debate on data centers continues. certainly here in the state of Michigan.
Yes.
Whether or not they should be built here, whether or not they're good for communities, tax bases, property taxes, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Water, electric, all that.
Yes, certainly the utility side of things, absolutely. Yeah. And we've seen other states take a different approach, states like Ohio,
mm-hmm.
where there are dozens and dozens and dozens of these things all over the place. And now they've
to the point they're taken, kind of slowing down a little bit, right?
Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, what, they have somewhere near 100 mm-hmm. data centers already built?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, each state is going to take a different approach, and everybody's going to have their own set of concerns and whatnot. But there is still this consternation around artificial intelligence as well. And are these two things connected? Are they joined at the hip, data centers and artificial intelligence, when it comes to public perspective? Ben Geeman is the energy reporter at Axios and joins us once again this morning. Ben, it's good to have you back.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's talk about the correlation here. Obviously, to scale up the next iteration of what artificial intelligence is, they need these data centers, these massive intelligence hubs that are going to be able to power this technology. And with that comes, as Lloyd mentioned, the utilities, the water, the electricity that's going to be needed to power these facilities. How is both the data centers influencing artificial intelligence and vice versa when it comes to public opinion?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, because certainly there's a lot of public consternation about whether or not AI is going to be ultimately taking a lot of jobs. So I really don't think that can be untethered from a lot of these concerns that we're seeing about data centers. And this has risen high up on the political and policy radar really quickly. I mean, our reporting and reporting by a lot of others shows that public polling is finding that there is widespread opposition to these things, and often opposition among people who don't even necessarily live that close to these facilities. And I think you're sort of seeing a couple of different kind of camps emerge among policymakers, right? I mean, one thing that just happened yesterday was that a pretty prominent lawmaker, Representative Frank Pallone of New Jersey, a Democrat who is the ranking member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, came out in favor of a nationwide moratorium on new data centers until water and electricity bill concerns and other things can be addressed. You know, I think what's sort of closer to the political mainstream, at least for the moment, is sort of, you know, enable these data centers, keep them going, allow them to be built, but with a whole bunch of new safeguards, right? So you recently had a powerful, although somewhat obscure, administrative body called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission telling a lot of big regional grid operators, saying essentially, look, get your act together on making sure that these giant tech companies and data center developers, when they build these things, they're not essentially sticking consumers with the bill, right? So this is ensuring that the tech companies pay the cost of new generation, of new grid upgrades, of new transmission needed, and that kind of thing. And honestly, the big tech companies say that they are fine with that, right? I mean, their goal, right, they've got big bank accounts, and they want a lot of new power and a lot of new computing power ASAP. So I think they are very willing to sort of accept these new conditions. Now, whether that's enough to overcome this public backlash that we're seeing, I think that's a great question. And interestingly, this backlash, I think, is starting to become pretty bipartisan.
Ben, people seem more willing to pause construction than just outright oppose data centers. Does that suggest that, you know, people are just saying, listen, slow down a little bit and explain this to us?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, this is something that has, you know, the AI boom, I think, appeared on the horizon and got a lot closer, you know, pretty quickly, right? I mean, I don't think that many people had heard about the development of these massive new large language models, of the ChatGPTs and Claudes of the world. That all happened pretty fast. And I think that's exactly right. Suddenly, you've got a lot of these proposals for, you know, these massive data centers. And these are not, you know, your parents' data centers, right? I mean, data centers have been with us, you know, for a long, long time, decades, right? You know, they're doing everything from processing payments and email and storing photos on the cloud, all these kind of things. But these newer types of facilities, I mean, we're talking about facilities that are this size, you know, a gigawatt worth of capacity, right? I mean, that's basically enough to power hundreds of thousands of homes. So this is something that is really new on the horizon. And I think you're absolutely right. I think people are just sort of wanting to understand this a little better. And, you know, I think another thing is that there's a lot of debate right now about whether the fact that people's electricity bills are rising can be attributed to the sort of rise and construction of these and, you know, existence of these new data centers. And honestly, the evidence is really mixed, because electricity demand in the U.S. has been rising for the first time in a long time. Mm-hmm. But that's not just because of these data centers. It's for a whole bunch of different reasons, right? And so I think right now what the industry and what regulators are trying to do are sort of trying to better understand and, in fact, sort of rebut these claims that there's just this one-to-one correlation, right? Like data center shows up, your power bills rise. It's a lot more complicated than that. And, in fact, there's a sort of emerging school of thought among some researchers that says, in fact, where you have a lot of more data centers, power bills tend to be rising more slowly, right? Because you can kind of spread the costs of what would have been needed grid upgrades and new transmission across more power buyers, and that, you know, basically that these tech companies are willing to pay sort of special rates for their power. So, you know, the link between power, consumers' power bills and data centers is really a little bit fuzzy. And I think that the tech companies, honestly, were a little bit slow on the draw to sort of push back against this kind of broad public perception that it is their products, basically, that are driving up power bills.
Ben Geeman, really interesting stuff. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it. Let's talk again soon. This isn't going anywhere, is it?
Absolutely not. No. And thank you so much.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. It's interesting because the numbers are wildly opposed.
Mm-hmm.
38% of people said they would support a data center being built by their home, while 34% say they would oppose it. 49% say they want the moratorium on constructions, while 16%. So it's not like people oppose the idea of them.
That's like I said, you know, most of these people, they don't oppose them. They just kind of like want you to slow down and explain it to them.
But I think Michigan is the perfect example of what's happening across the country. Now, you do have states like Ohio that have embraced them.
Yeah.
Michigan's a little different because people either A, are worried about how it impacts them, their utility rates or their property taxes. But then they're also worried that they're not being given all the information by these companies.
That's right.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fair critique.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you've got the other side, which is where I tend to fall a little bit more. This idea of, do you really want to miss out on this? You really want all the other states to reap the
because
benefits.
Because it's happening. It's coming.
Michigan's already fallen in a number of really important areas.
Yes.
Now we're gonna thumb our nose at this. I don't know if that's necessarily the way to go. So Michigan is a very interesting model for this national conversation.
Yeah, and I think they're looking at what everybody else is doing, and they're trying to, you know, put things in place to make sure that Michigan is covered and prepared.
Yeah.
When and if these data centers come.
John James in the 8 o'clock hour on his big endorsement. It's next. 8 o'clock hour. Good to have you here on a Thursday, as Lloyd says.
Friday Eve.
Yes.
Yay!
Just a day away. Day away.
It'll be here
before you
know it.
My coffee's almost gone. It's quite sad.
Is it? I know you've been getting down with the coffee this morning.
Yeah, I've been chugging coffee.
Well, okay.
I went to the Tiger game last night.
I mean, you
and
know. Full disclosure, I had a Red Bull.
And
a 5-hour mixed together. That's my little cocktail.
Oh, gas. No, Bright Swinney.
Exactly right.
It's hard.
Look, there's still nothing to beat a baseball game.
No.
There's something about it.
It's just fun, man.
But it does stink when the back-to-back Cy Young winner gives up three solo shots to the New York Yankees.
You don't want that.
And they lose 4-2.
No, you don't like that.
It is a bit of a bummer. And Tarek Skubal, he says the stuff is there, but the results aren't there yet.
Just not good enough, you know. Put our team in another position where they got to come back and win a ball game, and it's just not good enough. That's kind of how I look at it.
Fair. I mean, it's kind of a zero-sum game. I mean, you can pitch really well and still lose, and you got a little solace there. But, I mean, they just couldn't put enough bats on the balls yesterday, and, you lose the game.
Yeah. Detroit Lions cornerback Terrion Arnold in police custody today after turning himself into authorities in Tampa, Florida. Last night, the 23-year-old faces 4 counts of kidnapping, 4 counts of armed robbery. Prosecutors allege Arnold coordinated and directed a group of people to lure, rob, and beat 3 men in retaliation for a theft of at his Airbnb property, about $200,000 worth of merchandise and cash. And convicted, he faces up to life in prison. Through his representation, Arnold strongly denied the allegations, maintaining his innocence and calling the evidence unreliable. Now, he'll have a detention hearing later on this afternoon, and I know the prosecution wants him to be held in jail until the trial. His defense is going to want to get him bond. And we talked to Todd Flood earlier, and he said this is what has to be done to try to get him out on bond.
Well, but the burden for the defense is simply this. It has to show that he's not a threat to the community and that he's not a flight risk, right? We have to be able to show that, you know, he's going to have obviously a magnifying glass on him wherever he goes if he were let out on a bond, right? It would be a celebrity person. So he's not going to be able to basically, you know, get out of the United States. He's going to have a passport issue. He's going to have, you know, cameras following him everywhere.
And you can hear that full interview on WJR.com. The Lions issued a statement saying, yeah, we're aware of the situation, but we're not going to comment out of respect for the ongoing legal process.
Sure. Donald Trump calling for the Justice Department to investigate major oil companies, accusing them of keeping gasoline prices artificially high despite the sharp drop in crude oil prices that we've seen over the last couple of days. And he says that that should be translating to lower prices at the pump. Again, it's not quite like flipping a switch.
Yeah.
But I think the president's sentiments are right-ish. You know, why are some of these gas stations still up in the mid-fours?
Yeah.
That is a bit surprising. But again, that's where they're at currently. And he says that that they need to be bringing down these gas prices immediately. You've got the oil industry representatives saying that gas prices don't fall as quickly as crude due to supply chain and refining factories, and that is obviously plays a factor here too.
Yeah.
But he says he needs an investigation into this.
The Illich organization expanding its gaming footprint with a new venture called Illich Gaming, aimed at growing its casino operations beyond the city of Detroit. The company says the new platform will seek to acquire a casino in Mississippi while increasing its ownership stake in Atlantic City's Ocean Casino Resort from 50% to full control. Now, if it's approved by regulators, Illich Gaming would eventually oversee three properties. It'll be Detroit's Motor City Casino, the Ocean Casino Resort in New Jersey, and the Scarlet Pearl Casino Resort in Mississippi. And Illich Company CEO Chris Illich will serve as chair of the new gaming platform, calling it a new chapter in the company's hospitality and entertainment business, building on nearly 30 years of operation in Detroit. The expansion is still subject to regulatory approval before any deals are finalized.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, you know, so they're branching out. And I thought, well, Chris runs the Tigers. I didn't think he could have anything to do with the casinos. But he can't. He's going to be the chair of the new gaming platform. He'll be the chair. That's different than ownership.
Yes.
Because Marion Illich is the owner of, like, Motor City Casino.
Yes.
Yeah.
By the way, if you want to see something absolutely fantastic.
Okay.
Watch English soccer fans line dancing in Texas.
This is the latest from the World Cup?
It's my new favorite. These folks have no idea what's happening. God bless them. They're out there trying. But they, some of them have, like, you know, cowboy hats on and the whole deal.
Yeah.
But not a lot of rhythm for the English when it comes to line dancing.
I got to check it out.
The storylines for this World Cup have been absolutely fantastic.
Man. Oh, I was
telling. If it ain't the Scottish drink in the bars dry in Boston, it's, you know,
we're going to get drunk before the game. We're going to get drunk during the game, and then we're going to get drunk after the game.
It's the English fans down in Texas. It's the ranch that these fans are trying to bring back.
I was telling Marie
home
about that this morning. I was like, you know, they're smuggling ranch back. She was like, what? I was like, yeah. I said, maybe, listen, if we need some ranch, we just go to TSA at Detroit Metro. Say, listen, can I get a couple of bottles? Because I know you guys have a big container full of ranch. She says, oh, they're taking that home. What are you talking? You're not going to get any. They're going to take it.
I saw a couple guys at the Tiger game last night wearing the three Lions. Yeah. They're English guys wearing English jerseys.
Uh-huh.
And my guys were in the bag. They are just having a great time. I wanted to ask them, you know, are you guys from around here? Yeah. Like, you know, and because they were fully decked out in their English soccer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did you just make a pit stop? It was hard to have a conversation with them. Put it that way.
Okay.
My man had a Modelo. He was vibing.
He was
so I'm like, I don't think this is going to be great research for the show. I don't think I'm going to get great information out of you.
Did you see the Swedish fans that showed up at the Cubs game?
No, I didn't see
them. The Swedish soccer fans were doing the rowing. In the crowd. There was a lot of them there.
The who?
Yes.
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 Oh, during the Cubs game.
Is that the? That's not the Swedish fans. That's the.
Is it the Norwegian fans?
Norwegian fans. Okay. Yeah. Yes, the Norwegian fans. They were doing the rowing at the Cubs game.
They were doing the rowing and chanting.
Yes, they were.
It was like this is the loudest baseball game I've ever seen ever on TV.
Well, it was the Scottish fans. They went to a Red Sox game, and they were just singing the whole time.
Yeah. The whole time, yeah.
Send them to the PGA Tour. That'll make it interesting.
Oh, my gosh.
It's great.
It's like a European Ryder Cup at home.
You wish that all the people that are so divided here would just see these people and go, look, we're actually a nice place to be.
Yes.
We should quit arguing about nonsense and just enjoy what we are, ranch dressing and beer.
Truthfully.
Yeah. That's it in a nutshell. You said it.
Did you just create something, Brian?
Yeah, we need to put that on a billboard going up to Mackinac next year. We're just ranch dressing and beer.
JR Morning, ranch dressing and beer.
Exactly. If there is one thing that I think should bridge people together here is like, guys, we got it pretty good.
No.
It's pretty great here.
I mean, when you compare it to other places.
Yeah, it's pretty darn good. I mean, like, you know. we can squabble over the silliness and the nonsense and all that stuff. And I mean, we're going to celebrate 250 here.
Yeah, we are.
It's a pretty darn good place.
Well, they're celebrating thousands over there. So yeah, 250 but is who pretty cares? Young, but at the same time.
Who cares?
You need to look at what the good part is. Looking at the bad's always easy. Looking at the good's harder. Ranch dressing and beer, baby.
Shouldn't have been taxing RT. How about that?
There you go. Hello.
Coming up on the other side, John James gets a big endorsement from Donald Trump. He'll join us at 8:19. But Michigan summers mean outdoor adventure and fun. You know that. It's the best place in the country for vacations. But high temperatures should never break your budget. And you need to count on Consumers Energy to help make the most of your season and your budget with tips and ways to save, like making small changes, like shifting some energy use to the morning or in the evening, or raising your thermostat just a couple of degrees, and maybe even doing laundry at night or on the weekends. All of these things can actually help lower your bill while keeping your home comfortable. So make sure you discover more ways to beat the heat at consumersenergy.com/summer. Well, Donald Trump has weighed in on a lot of the primaries happening across the country, and he finally did here in the gubernatorial race.
Yes, sir.
By the way, he did not endorse Jocelyn Benson. No.
Didn't think he would.
No, I didn't think so either. And we were, you know what? We hit the nail on that head.
We did.
But he did endorse John James. And that certainly, I imagine, would give John a big boost.
Yeah.
Going into this primary come August 4th. And Congressman John James joins us this morning to talk about it. Congressman, it's good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me back on, guys. Good morning.
What does this endorsement mean for you, for your campaign, for fundraising efforts, all of those things? How do things change now?
Well, the president's a friend, and we've been supportive of each other for the better part of the past decade. I'm grateful for the president's support, but the battle is not won yet. We have a lot of work to do. We have early voting starting this week. And please remind all of your friends that the primary ends on August 4th. If you'd like more information, go to johnjamesmi.com. But again, we're grateful for the president's support, but I'm going to be going all around the state to earn yours as well.
The president has had mixed results endorsing candidates recently. Do endorsements still carry the same political weight they once did, Congressman?
Of course, and that's a great point. The president is undefeated in federal races in Michigan and statewide races. I'm excited to have his support. People in the state of Michigan recognize that we need to begin to unify, consolidate, because we cannot beat the Democrats and turn our state around with half a Republican Party. And when you see what's happening in New York and around the country, the Democrat socialism is on the march. And Republicans are being called right now to stand against the forces that would tear our nation down to its studs, ironically, on our 250th birthday. So we need to come together. We need to support the president. We need to make sure that we are working together to ensure that our children have a better and brighter future, and we turn the state around from the damage that Jocelyn Benson and Whitmer administration has done over the past 7.5 years.
You know, you've gotten a number of high-profile endorsements, obviously the president being the latest one, but there still needs to be work done on voter turnout. And historically, during primaries, people don't get out to the numbers that we would all like. I think everybody should vote in every single election.
Absolutely.
No matter what's on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
How does that impact the way that your campaign is operating at this point?
Well, that's such a great point. Midterms are turnout elections, and midterm primaries especially, which is the reason why I've been to 83 counties around the state of Michigan, which is why I've had hundreds of stops, public and otherwise, around the state of Michigan, because this is going to be won in the trenches. I'm a combat aviation pilot, ranger qualified. Nobody's going to outwork me. So while I'm doing my duty for the state of Michigan, being deployed here to the swamp, I'm still getting around the state and making sure people hear a message of what we're going to do to bring educational excellence, economic mobility, public safety, accountable government, and healthy families. These are the messages that are resonating, which is why I was ahead by double digits in the primary prior to the president's election, why we'll continue to widen that margin, and why we're going to wrap our arms around the entire party to focus on one objective, which is beating the Democrats in November and turning our state around for all 10 million Michiganders for the next 4 years.
Congressman, you represent a competitive congressional district, and, you know, some Republicans worry that leaving the House could put that seat at risk. Why was the governor job the right thing for you to do at this point?
You know, that's a great question. I've always answered the call. From the time that I went into the military, I went to war after 9/11, I answered the call for a nation that was under attack. I came back after the Great Recession to help grow jobs in Detroit. I answered the call for people who were increasingly hopeless that they could have a life they would be proud of and put more money in their pockets. And I would help provide jobs in Michigan and the city of Detroit, answering the call. And then once again, when our republic was under attack with open borders and extremist policies, I ran for office and won and stood against the extremism that that frankly threatens our way of life. Supporting the president's agenda and making sure that we can have a country we can be proud of and pass on to our children. So once again, running for Michigan's governor, our state is on fire. 45th in total education. Our economic opportunities slipped from 19th to mid-30s in 1 year, and our children are leaving a state for better opportunity. Our state is on fire. I'm answering the call, and the Democrats' only answer is somebody who's currently being sued for racial discrimination, allowed illegals to vote, and can't even run a website. And so Michigan deserves better. We were made for more. And I'm answering the call to help Michigan a better place where we can all prosper under our own terms.
Yeah, and that was the topic of the panel that I hosted with John up on Mackinac Island. Mm-hmm. And Congressman, we appreciated your time for that. And that is a huge cause of concern and a huge focus for the next governor in this state is how do we turn these things around and quickly? And I do want to ask you also about what we've seen in the wake of this Donald Trump endorsement, actually even going back before it, because Tom Leonard, who was running for governor as well on the Republican side, had dropped out through his support behind your campaign. After the president endorsed you, Eric Nesbitt dropped out and threw his support behind you. Do you see a scenario, whether you win the primary, lose the primary, is there going to be a cohesion of Republicans in the state that are going to band together to support each other?
Republicans have always stood up to free men from bondage and hold our republic together, and we will do so once again. But in the state of Michigan, the Republican Party will unite. We will bind together to free men from mental and emotional bondage and to save our republic and to make Michigan great again. I have every hope that with somebody who's actually been to combat and brought people together to accomplish tough and dangerous missions, that I will be able to do it again, unifying our party, winning this election, and then bringing our state together to fix it and frankly, put out this fire. I'm willing to answer the call and run into the fire, and I just need everybody on our team to make sure that they're willing to hold the rope on the other end. I'm so excited for the opportunity to earn your support and your vote. And I think you can see with the president's endorsement, with my former opponent's endorsement, that the people who are in it for the right reasons, they were in it for you, Tom Leonard, Eric Nesbitt, they were in it for you. And right now they recognize that I'm in the best position to take the shot. I'm in the best position to win the general. And we together are going to fix our state.
Congressman, between now and August 4th, will we see a debate between you and Mike Cox and Perry Johnson?
I've accepted two debates, one in Southeast Michigan and Detroit. This is my good friend Rick Albin, and I'm looking forward to having our message out there for everybody.
A little bit of phone trouble there with you, Congressman, but you did. We heard you say that you did accept a couple of debates, which is good to hear. We appreciate your time as always. Thank you. Don't be a stranger. We'll talk again very soon.
Yes, sir. Look forward to it.
Have a good one, Congressman.
You got it.
Yeah.
But again, I do think it's a meaningful endorsement. Whether or not that's going to carry into November,
right?
We'll see. That's down the road.
That's down the road.
But Donald Trump has been, he's got a pretty darn good average when it comes to who these endorsements and when they're coming through in their primaries in these states.
Yeah.
The record doesn't lie there.
Well, and, you know, we had two drop, and we'll see how this goes with these debates because people want to hear, you know, what these candidates have to say. And the best way to do it is get out in front and talk to the people.
Certainly. Donald Trump to Capitol Hill today. Immigration on the docket. Iran on the docket. What do we expect to hear coming out of these conversations with lawmakers? We'll talk about that with Evan Brown next. It's JR Morning. Well, Donald Trump took a little jaunt over to the Capitol yesterday.
Yeah, and had some meetings. Uh-huh.
Had some, well, according to reports, some hot, testy meetings. GOP senators described this interaction between Donald Trump and Senator Bill Cassidy, who lost his primary bid in the state of Louisiana. GOP senators who were there described Trump as being, quote, mad as a murderer hornet.
Ooh.
According to a story in the New York Post.
Well, I know also yesterday, you know, they asked him, you know, are the Republicans unified? And he says, yeah, you know, we're unified. It's a couple I don't like.
Maybe he was talking about Bill Cassidy. Yeah. Let's talk about it with Eben Brown, our Fox News reporter and WJR contributor. Eben, good morning. Good to have you back. What happened yesterday?
Oh, I think there was a big blowout behind closed doors. It seems to get a little hot under the collar there between the president and Bill Cassidy, the outgoing, and when I mean outgoing, I mean the leaving senator from Louisiana. Mr. Cassidy lost his primary to a Trump-backed challenger, and there's really no love lost between the two men, and certainly no need for the senator to kiss any tail at this point. And yet, after the big blow-up, the senator was treated to a private classified briefing with the Vice President Vance about things going on in Iran, and then all of a sudden, Senator Cassidy changed his vote on the War Powers Resolution Act, and therefore, between that and Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, again, no friend to the president, no friend to his fellow Republicans, really, changed his vote to a present, then that War Powers Resolution Act died, and the president was not condemned for his military actions in Iran, which would have happened with those Republican help if things had not gotten changed. So I think what started yesterday really started when the president said, I'm not going to sign that housing bill, and they were all set to sign it. And I think that got the senators' attention, the Republican senators' attention, and they had a big old confab about it, and the president basically read them the riot act.
But that housing bill was supposed to be like a messaging win on affordability. How much of a missed opportunity is that?
I don't know. The president could still sign it anytime soon. You know, it's he didn't veto it, put it that way.
But it would, even if he didn't sign it, wouldn't it go into law in like 10 days anyway?
I mean, he has a certain time to sign it, or it can be, you know, it can get pocket vetoed or something like
right.
that. So,
okay.
You know, I think it was a calculated risk. Obviously, it was enough to get the senator's attention where they agreed to come meet with him or host him for a meeting and to have kind of air this out. You know, one of the president's big complaints about the Senate Republicans is that they don't really help him much. They also don't act like a majority. They usually fumble their own ball. And that's sort of been a problem that Republican presidents have had with Republican senators for a while. And the president has tried to encourage them to do things like kill off the filibuster to get things done because the Democrats themselves have done that. And why the Republicans refuse to play the same game the Democrats do is sort of beyond, I think, the president's understanding. The president would rather them be more aggressive, and he's made that overture again and again and again. And there were some rumors that he kind of had words with John Thune, the Senate Majority Leader, about this and whatnot. So, you know, the president knows he needs to keep control of the House and Senate after the midterms. Otherwise, he faces impeachment yet again. So I think he wants to kind of hurry up and get the ball down the field here, and that means getting certain things passed.
I mean, obviously, the president came in with a message, and it sounds like that message was delivered. And There was even some thanks on the behalf of Senator Cassidy to Steve Witkoff and Vice President J.D. Vance, because it sounds like they got a breakdown of some of the negotiations that have been happening, too.
Yeah, I mean, there was a change in tone from what we've normally seen from Senator Cassidy. Maybe he was, maybe his concerns were alleviated, or maybe something else happened. But, you know, the senator is now going to essentially be leaving office, showing that he could play ball if he had to.
On immigration, this comes as a federal judge says now block key parts of the president's executive order on voter registration and citizenship proof. How significant is that ruling in practical terms?
Well, the president has not had good luck with the federal district courts. He has much better luck at the appellate level and the Supreme Court. So if he has to fight this all the way to the Supreme Court, he will. The president is really, you know, more interested, I think, in the Save America Act and wants that passed. Because that's a piece of legislation. It's much stronger, if you will, than an executive order. Executive orders are very flimsy, you know, speaking in terms of you know, policy mandating. So the president can do a lot of things with executive orders and then have those executive orders, you know, stopped or overturned by court pretty easily. Legislation, it makes it a bit harder because there's a bit more, you know, oomph to a legislation to a passed bill. That's kind of where we're at. I think the president will fight these battles in any venue he has to.
Well, and then the issue of the Save America Act, the Voter Eligibility Act, also came up. And many Republicans, Tom Tillis, John Thune, have said if nuking the filibuster is the option, it's not going to happen. But there are other plans on the table as well. The president wants to get this through.
He does. And look, I think the president has made the case again and again, and he's won, I think, a number of battles in terms of, you know, winning people to his side on this, and that there's a problem with allowing people who are not qualified to vote, and that needs to stop. And while there is a great deal of law and precedent that give states the power over managing elections, there are still basic laws about elections that have to be followed that come from the federal end and can be federally enforced. So I think the president's just going to fight those battles in whichever venue he can, whether it's through legislation with the Congress, through an executive order, and eventually through the courts.
Interesting stuff as always, Evan Brown. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah, we'll talk soon. But this is, you know, it's funny because historically, when there are disagreements, even inside your own party, presidents will make the trip over to the Capitol and they'll have
a little confab and they'll work it out.
Nice conversation, probably over coffee or whatever. And they'll work it out.
They'll work it out, yeah.
Donald Trump's approach is a little different.
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, you know.
He's going to go in there and he's going to light the drapes on fire.
Uh-huh.
And he's going to peel the paint off the walls.
And when he comes out, he's going to tell you that, you know.
Yeah.
There's a couple I don't really like, but yeah, I get along with everybody.
But again, this is the management style of Donald Trump.
It is.
If he believes that this is the path that needs to go, there will be pushback, right? Of course there will be. Yeah. There will be people that disagree with that path forward.
Yeah.
But in a situation where you've got a fork in the road with two roads that are running parallel to each other, it's a matter of moving this around, moving
there
that around, let's get people over here.
That's right.
And see what we can do. So it's a little bit like playing checkers. You're just trying to get everything where you need it to go so that eventually you can put yourself in a position to win. And that's what Donald Trump does.
Part of the deal.
Does really well. Well, I don't know if it's so much a deal making. It's more of here's my position and I'm the president.
Yeah.
Shouldn't you also be on that same wavelength?
Yeah, but if you go against me, I'll do something that will get you back to the table and we'll make a deal.
Well, even John Thune, though, has been, you know, he's been pretty steadfast on the filibuster not going
anywhere.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Now, if that happens later on and the Democrats, you know, decide to make that change, I think they take the heat for it.
I don't think
Republicans should. I don't think anybody should do anything with the filibuster.
No.
But that's something that they're going to have to deal with. And then the president even thanked John Thune later on. So, mm-hmm. Again, a difference of position, but yet still seems like they're on working terms, which is, you know, not so much with Bill Cassidy.
Cassidy, right.
This is the way of the world sometimes with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Coming up on the other side, the Pistons NBA draft in the books, how'd they do? We'll talk about it. Share morning. All right, so the NBA draft is wrapped.
Yes, sir.
Pistons add a couple of players. And also, they trade Isaiah Stewart away.
Yes, they do.
And so what are the ramifications of that trade? Let's talk to Eric Vincent, our Detroit Pistons beat reporter for ClutchPoints.com. E, it's good to have you back, my friend.
My pleasure. How you guys doing this morning?
We're good.
We're good. I saw some fan reaction to the Isaiah Stewart trade, and it was mixed, honestly. Obviously, he brings a lot off the bench, great rebounder, you know, averaging under 10 points a game, but he brings an edge to this team that I think was needed. But they get a lot of financial flexibility because of this move. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I was stunned. You know, Beef Stew has been one of the, you know, focal point beginning players of the restoration period for the Detroit Pistons. You know, coming a part of that, you know, core four, you know, in 2020 drafted by Troy Weaver. And the franchise spoke so highly of him. Fans, teammates, front office, coaching staff, calling him the backbone of this defense and of this franchise. But at a period now where the Pistons are past their evaluation period and they're looking for championship, you know, expectations, these are the kind of moves that you have to make. You know, he had some good impact in the playoffs and some games. But however, he was kind of outplayed by Paul Reed, and he was made a little bit more expendable considering the circumstances. And with Jalen Duren still looking as being their franchise big of the future, it made Stu a little bit more expendable than the other two guys. So, you know, it was definitely shocking. I think the return of whatever this deal is going to determine, you know, the value of how good this trade is, or this trade is going to be for the Pistons. But very shocking, not to say the less. I mean, we definitely wish Stu the best, and definitely did not see this coming, to be honest.
Eric, what do you think about this cash to buy the 53rd pick from the Knicks and pick up this 7-foot center, Ugano Ayinzo from Virginia? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'd be lying to say if I, you know, had a huge, you know, gauge on his, you know, game prior to the move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it helps them to have some size. You know, Stu was a little undersized. And, you know, obviously same with Paul Reed, being like kind of like 6'8", 6'9", players. So it helps to get a little bit more size. You know, how much they'll have to lean on him is going to be a question mark in itself as of right now. But, you know, I don't mind it. I think they needed some beef in the front court. I think he offers them some length and some shooting and some versatility at the position. But luckily at this point in the Pistons' future, they're not over-relying on their rookies, their young guys, to come in and make an immediate impact, which shows how much progress that they've made. So he'll be able to take gradual steps, you know, within his development, and hopefully it'll take him and the Pistons far in a good winning direction.
Yeah, I think that's the key point here, is like fans were ragging on him for these,
yeah,
these picks,
mm-hmm,
and even going to the Abuko Corey trade and they get him on board. You know, he's a speedster. He's got handles. He's got patience. He can shoot the ball. Yes, Stanford stinks, but that's okay. I mean, they're not expecting him to start right away. So they've got their core. They got a couple of accompanying pieces to that core. And then they want to go out, it sounds like, to make an actual trade for a guy that's going to be able to come in and score a bunch of points and lead this team to the next that next plateau. So I don't have a problem with really either of these picks, because I don't think they're going to be impactful players here initially.
Yeah, I like the upside of Abuko Corey. I think he could be a really good player in the NBA, but I think kind of as the roster stands right now, it kind of looks like kind of what they had with the Beef Stew situation. You have three other point guards that are in front of him right now. So you have Cade, Danish Jenkins, and then Marcus Sasser. And then trading up for him was kind of, to me, a bit of a question mark if they plan on keeping him, because, again, you're going to have to create opportunity for him to get the best out of that value, and it's going to be a little tough when you just gave, you know, Danis extension, and then you still have Sasser on the books, you know, on the roster. So they're going to have to find a way to clear his area if they're going to try to get the most out of him. I definitely thought they were going to maybe use that pick to try to land a trade. It's still possible that, you know, maybe they could work something out, you know, with some of the other assets that they have within the roster and with their other draft flexibility. So I don't think trades is done. I think he's making it very clear that they are trying to get some help around Cade Cunningham, that they do have, you know, bigger postseason expectations. He spoke about that during the draft and after as well. So I think he's making it pretty clear what he's trying to do. I like it. I like the aggressiveness. I like the intention. Because you don't want to waste this kind of window and this kind of time when you're in an Eastern Conference that's open and you have an MVP caliber player in Cade Cunningham. You want to make these kind of moments count the best you can.
Does the activity from the
from the night, the draft night, kind of tell you that Trajan is thinking this team is right on the cusp of a deep playoff run? Or is he still kind of selectively kind of tearing down parts of the old foundation to build it his way?
I think he understands the magnitude of the moment now. The past couple seasons, he's talked about, you know, this being an evaluation period, you know, bringing in J.B. Bickerstaff his first season, still kind of learning what the young players were capable of, guys like Jaden Ivey, guys like Asar Thompson, Jalen Duren, Cade Cunningham, seeing how they could gel together and see how far they could take this team, especially when they were adding new veteran pieces like Tobias Harris, Tim Hardaway Jr., Malik Beasley. You wanted to see what was possible with those core guys. And I think he, at this point, has his answers. I think he knows that he wants Jalen Duren a part of the future. Cade is obviously the building, you know, core centerpiece. Asar Thompson, he obviously wants to be here as well. He spoke on wanting to build around them as the core three for this team. But you're going to have to do that with some proven, you know, bucket getters instead of just relying on young internal development. You know, that helps and that is valuable to have. But in this Eastern Conference and the NBA in general, everybody has multiple scoring punches, and you got to be able to keep up with that. We see Cade Cunningham struggle and kind of get tired as the season goes on with the workload that he has playing heliocentric basketball. We see his turnovers go up. We see a lot more added on his work plate. And you got to find a way to get him some help, and I think that's what they're trying to do now.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Eric Vincent, we appreciate your time as always. Thank you, and we'll talk soon.
Sounds good, fellas. Yeah, have a good one for you.
You got it.
As well.
You too.
You just bring in Kawhi and LeBron, and you'll be good.
That's
right?
it. That's all
you got to do, right?
That's all you got to do.
Say what?
Just, just bring in guys who don't play full seasons anymore.
Nope.
Perfect. That's exactly what we need to get over the hump.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. all right, All Talk coming your way next. I believe it's Marie Osborne filling in. Good. Marie's coming up next here on WJR. We'll see you tomorrow on a Friday. Have a good one.